Today at Reader's Corner, Michael McCarthy, author of Ashes Underwater, the SS Eastland and the Shipwreck That Shook America. I'm Bob Custer. Welcome to Reader's Corner. On a Sunday morning in July 1915, thousands of poor factory workers lined the Chicago docks, waiting to board ships for the much-anticipated annual picnic hosted by the Western Electric Company. But as 2,500 passengers flooded aboard the first ship, the SS Eastland, disaster struck. The huge liner flipped onto its side, drowning more than 800 people in the filthy Chicago River, including 22 whole families. Following the disaster, the city and the nation called for swift justice. Several men were quickly indicted, including the ship's young engineer, a Norwegian immigrant, whose heroic action following the disaster prevented even greater loss of life. Representing him in a shadowy trial that exposed the corruption of the era was a lawyer whose once stellar career was reeling from recent charges of bribing a juror, Clarence Darrow. Darrow would later gain fame for defending John Scopes in what became known as the Scopes Monkey Trial and for other high-profile legal work. Today's guest, Michael McCarthy, recounts the awful tragedy of the SS Eastland and its aftermath in his book, Ashes Underwater. He is a former longtime reporter and editor for the Wall Street Journal and the author of a previous book, The Sun Farmer. Today we're featuring an encore edition of our interview with Michael McCarthy. Mr. McCarthy joins us today by phone for this interview. Michael McCarthy, welcome to Reader's Corner.
Thank you, Bob. I'm very happy to be here with you.
So, Michael, in modern-day Chicago, if you want to go off to a nice little recreational opportunity, you just hop in your car and you drive down the Dan Ryan or the tollway, and you head to the interstate, and before you know it, you're in New Buffalo and then Benton Harbor and South Haven and Saugatuck and Holland, all wonderful places along the lake. Of course, this was 1915. Henry Ford had barely rolled his first Model T off the assembly line, so there weren't many people jumping in their cars. There was an entire different culture of travel and recreation going on that I wonder if you could help us understand these big ships that were traveling from Chicago over to Michigan to recreate.
Sure. First of all, you have to understand that Chicago was a very, as you mentioned in your introduction, filthy city. It was really dirty, really hot, and there was really no respite in the summertime for people. So a lot of people would hop aboard a steamship and take a three-hour cruise and end up on one of the nice beach towns along Michigan. The car was in existence, but there were really no highways, and hardly anyone owned them. So if you wanted to travel, if you wanted to have a recreational experience, you were on a steamship. The other thing I'd point out is that a lot of people were very aspirational about steamships. If you looked at the newspaper, and again, we're prior to radio, we're prior to television, so the only media there was the newspaper. People would be flipping through their newspapers, and they would see these fabulous steamships and rich people with their trunks of clothes and their poodles and so forth. And they would look and say, that's what people who have lots of money do, and I want to do that. So along comes a steamship industry throughout the Great Lakes that for about a dollar for a round trip can take you just like the rich people. And you get to enjoy a very aspirational experience as lush and embellished as anyone with all the money in the world could have. Mm-hmm.
So since we at the moment don't have the benefit of the photos in the middle of your book, help our listeners understand the size of this steamship.
So we're talking about nearly the length of a football field, and you're looking up about 35, 40 feet. So it's enormous. It's you know, not quite of the grandeur of the cruise ships we see out of Miami and so forth now, but quite a large ship, and it could handle as many as 3,000 people. It had carried 3,000 people. That's a stunning number of people to think about on a single vessel. But on our particular day when the Eastland capsized in the Chicago River, it had 2,500 passengers aboard.
Now, of course, the SS Eastland, the SS stands for steamship, and you have one chapter in your book entitled Sleeping on a Volcano, which gets to the point that this ship is powered basically by fuel. I don't know whether they were using fuel oil or whether they were using coal or wood at that time, but I think you pointed out it's like a floating bomb.
It is. So most of the steamships of this era were powered by coal. And if you think about it, the way a coal-fired ship worked is, as I mentioned in the book, it's essentially like you immersed a tea kettle in the water. So you are heating up with coal and fire. You're heating up water to super, super heated temperatures. And at that point, the steam is pushed through very narrow compartments into pistons that turn and turn the propellers and so forth. So all of this at this time is coal-fired. And we're talking tons of coal per ship. The same thing, the same way we powered the Titanic. If you remember or saw that movie, the coal room with the men taking the shovels and throwing the things into these fiery furnaces, that is exactly the way the Eastland and most ships on the Great Lakes were powered at this time.
And I think you point out that this is a pretty dangerous proposition, and there were a number of accidents and fires over the years where people perished as a result of this particular form of combustion.
Right. It was an experimental time, and certainly in the late 1800s, the problem was quite dramatic. In fact, led to the formation of unions because crew members were afraid to get on these things. Unscrupulous owners would not make proper repairs, would not use proper metal in fabrication. And what would happen is if a superheated, it's called a boiler, literally, it's a great term. If a superheated boiler, which is boiling the water to power the steam turbines, if that touches cold river water or cold ocean water, and it happened several times, quite a few times in the late 1800s, early 1900s, and in fact, even into World War II, they can blow up catastrophically, just awful, horrific explosions from these things as they were beginning to try and sort out this powerful technology and how to properly kind of constrain it.
So it's 1915, and most of these issues have been figured out, so everybody thinks the SS Eastland is pretty safe as far as this particular issue of combustion is concerned. Describe the innards of the SS Eastland. I was surprised myself at just how ornate the inside of the ship really was.
Right. So there's an immense dance floor in the order of 30 by 60 feet or so. All wooden. There is a bar, a saloon. There's a grand staircase, which is spindles, beautiful wooden carved spindles up the side, both sides. And people are stepping in their elegant gowns, the women in floor-length dresses, the men with their dapper derbies and suit ties and suits, and walking up and down. There's dancing going on inside. There's several bands. There's beer. There's soft drinks, hamburgers sizzling on the grill. It's quite a carnival-type atmosphere. And, you know, throughout, passengers are experiencing, as I say, the same sort of trappings of the upper class and the robber barons of the time.
So this thing's traveling at 20 miles an hour. What's its destination? Is it going to South Haven? Is that where the passengers get off? They spend some time during the day and then come back by evening? What's the program here?
Yeah. So this is a second trip that the Eastland was going to make for the same company. Western Electric is a very large, in fact, the largest employer in the city of Chicago at the time, manufacturing company, big factory, and it produces telephones. The telephone is just now beginning to make its appearance in offices. It wasn't even quite a household item yet. The company employs thousands of people, and it took in 1914 7,000 employees on a trip to Indiana, right across Lake Michigan, and it employed five steamships. The thing went off great, no problem. So they did it for 1915 as well, employed the same five steamships, including the Eastland. Unfortunately, the second picnic, the second time around, did not go as well as the first.
You're listening to Reader's Corner. My guest today is Michael McCarthy, author of Ashes Underwater, the SS Eastland, and the Shipwreck That Shook America. Well, let's talk about that for a minute. What went wrong? I know that you spend chapters talking about what went wrong, so it's not easy in a few minutes to sum that up. But if you could help us explain just what did happen and caused this unbelievable tilt that eventually threw the whole boat over on its side.
Sure. Let's go to the dock first. We are in late July, 1915, Chicago. It's a drizzly Saturday morning. The Eastland is standing at its dock. It's tied up both sides, the front and back, the stern and bow are tied to the dock. 2,500 people are making their way across the gangplank. It's about 7 in the morning when the ship begins to tip toward the dock, toward the direction of as people are boarding. The engineers take some countermeasures below in the engine room to stabilize the ship. They get it straightened up. It then begins to tip away from the passengers toward the riverside. Okay, so now it's moving the other direction. The engineers again take counter steps to balance the ship out. They get it on an even keel. It's straightened out. Passengers still loading. Virtually everyone is aboard at this time. It's only been about 25 minutes that this has all happened. The ship then begins to lean once again toward the riverside, away from the passengers, away from the dock. One of the bow lines snaps. Another one snaps. Finally, the stern line snaps, and the ship goes over, and it quickly drowns 844 people, most of them children and women.
You mentioned that when the first when the ship first started to tilt, the engineers under the ship were working on how they could fix this. And I believe this has to do with the ballast tanks. Will you explain just what the engineers were trying to do that would right the ship?
Right. So the Eastland used a ballast system. Ballast is simply a fancy nautical word for weight. And in the case of the Eastland, it used water weight. So there was a hole, literally a hole in the side of the ship that they would unscrew a lid to, and water would pour in, water would gush in, and they would move it around through a series of pipes to holding tanks, tanks that were in the base, the bottom of the ship. And if they wanted to, they could direct that water, say, to the dockside to lower the boat a little bit, maybe to make it more comfortable for passengers to get on. And if they wanted to straighten it up, they could simply move the water to the other side of the ship. So they're constantly doing these maneuvers of shifting the water inside to tilt the ship forward to the port side, to the starboard side, whatever they wanted to do, they could do this. The problem was, and what I discovered in my research is that the system could easily go haywire. There were at least two other times that the ship capsized, because what they found was once the water was inside the ship, once it had been allowed to get in, they couldn't really pump it around and move it effectively. So as they're trying to counterbalance the weight, as they're trying to tilt it one direction instead of the other, things could get out of hand and they couldn't shift it back quickly enough. And that's exactly what happened on this morning, July 24th, 1915 in Chicago.
So what changes were made to the Eastland along the way? Because this incident was not the first one that the Eastland had. Now, obviously, it tilted before. It never went over on its side. So you might help us understand previous encounters the Eastland had with this problem. And were there any changes made to accommodate for it?
So in 1904, just outside South Haven, where I live now, the Eastland was out away from the dock, still visible to the shore. And it went into a bizarre tilt. The ship tilted to the starboard side, and the engineers tried to do their countermeasures, as I mentioned, the way they tried in the Chicago River many years earlier, but we're in 1904, 11 years before the Eastland disaster. The ship tilts, and women and men are frightened because this ship is on a tilt. They're out in the middle of Lake Michigan, and they're fearful. So the women start grabbing life preservers, and the men do too. Women are screaming. People are trying to get the life preservers on. It's quite a chaotic scene. And the engineer is trying desperately to right the ship, to get it on a stable basis again. But he can't do it. It's not moving. And they don't understand why. We only understood later that the stabilizing equipment was quite chaotic and not nearly responsive enough. So the crew ordered all the passengers to go down into the ship, thinking that moving, you know, tons of weight lower to the lower portion of the ship would help stabilize it. But people were afraid to go down, so they wouldn't. So the crew's response was to take a fire hose and start squirting them. They started firing water at them, soaking them, and forcing them to go downstairs. Between that action and between the efforts of the ballast adjustments that the engineers made, they finally were able to straighten the ship out and go on to the dock in Chicago, which was their ultimate destination. But when they got there, the women still had their life preservers on, sitting on the decks, and they were clutching them. So newspaper reporters all showed up and said, "What's going on? What's happening with Eastland? Why are these women wearing life preservers in the river as they're landing?" And they had a great story. So that story was written up. It was written up in Chicago. It was written up on the Michigan side. But unfortunately, after the ship was in Chicago, run out of the Chicago market, and people were afraid to ride on it anymore, the owner sold it and sent it out to Lake Erie. We're in a way pre-internet age, pre-television and pre-radio. So what happened was people forgot. The news, the problems didn't travel as the ship traveled to Lake Erie. All right, now there's a problem out on Lake Erie. There's a big Sherwin-Williams picnic, and this ship began its same sort of topsy-turvy seesawing behavior. So those owners sell it and send it back to Chicago. So what it's basically doing, it has this checkered history with near capsizes, and they simply move it around as a way to let that legacy disappear. And it's at that time it arrives in Chicago with a new ownership who they'd only run it one season. But here's the thing that I found that was so stunning to me, and one of the big reasons I wrote the book. What I discovered in the National Archives was a signed confession. There was a whistleblower on the Eastland who had evidence of a crime. And that whistleblower was Joseph Erickson. He was the chief engineer of the Eastland, the number two officer on the ship after the captain. Now, he told the Chicago police chief about a discussion he had with the Eastland owners in May of 1915. This is just a few weeks before our disaster, mind you. In that conversation, they planned to make specific repairs. They wanted to repair the Eastland's tendency to tip excessively. But then when they heard the cost and the amount of time involved, the owners chose to postpone those repairs. 6 weeks later, the ship capsizes. Now, we haven't known this. We haven't known that the Eastland disaster might never have happened had the owners followed through and fixed the stabilizing machinery. So to me, that constitutes criminal negligence. And I felt that this was a grave injustice to all these women and children who died, and that we needed a proper, full explanation of what happened.
Well, where there's criminal negligence, there's a prosecution. And part of your book discusses what happens when this gets to the courts. And, of course, Clarence Darrow is involved. But help us unwind just how this all comes about in the courts. It sounds to me, and again, I don't want to give anything away, but it really does. I guess I am going to give something away. I mean, the fact is everybody goes scot-free. But what the book does is explain why they go scot-free. And maybe we can spend a little bit of time here having you help us understand how this could have happened. And I also have to ask the question, I wonder what would have happened today. I suspect there would have been a more deliberate process as to what you're going to charge these folks with and in what court they're going to show up.
Sure. I am not afraid of spoiler alerts with this particular story right. Because the drama is so inherent that even if you know the outcome, you're still like, how could that have happened?
Yeah.
And that's what sort of pulled me through as well.
Yeah.
So you're right. What happened was I just mentioned that Joseph Erickson, the chief engineer, had told the police that the owners had plans to repair the ship, right? So when the ship owners realized that he had squealed on them, he was the whistleblower, they refused to let their attorneys represent him. They made him the scapegoat instead. They said, oh, he mishandled the engine room duties. So this underdog with pennies to his name did something remarkable. He finds an attorney better than any of the others on the legal team his rich bosses had assembled. He finds Clarence Darrow. So what happens? They get into the courtroom and, you know, you have 844 dead people. The nation was horrified, yeah. By the way. If you go back and look at the newspapers, and I did, front pages, coast to coast, had several weeks of coverage of this. It was an astonishing loss of life, the single greatest loss of life in the city of Chicago, yeah. To this day, 844 people, just unbelievable. So someone did something wrong. Look, we have a ship tied to a dock. It flips over. That's not an act of God. That's not an accident. Someone was criminally responsible for doing something inappropriate, right? So they bring the chief engineer, the captain, they bring two inspectors and two of the owners into court saying, you guys are responsible for this hellacious, you know, loss of life, and we are going to prosecute you to the fullest extent. But here's where it gets so unfortunate. The judge ends up throwing the case out on a technicality. On a technicality, he does. He rules that the indictments of the Eastland men pertain to safety laws for ships at sea, but not in a river. So in effect, he takes 10 days of testimony. There's over 90 witnesses. Everyone who had any knowledge of the accident was there. And the prosecutors bumbled because the charges they brought were poorly constructed. They did not come up with a good case to criminally make them responsible. But more important, Clarence Darrow, who's working for the defense, working for Joseph Erickson, who's the innocent engineer in our story, he sidetracked the judge with days of testimony around some phantom obstruction in the riverbed that he himself had dreamed up. He has some of his men haul very theatrically into the court some wooden columns that he said were under the water and tipped the Eastland over when no one else could have found these. And so where these came from, nobody knows. But the case was really over before it began.
I'm Bob Kustra, host of Reader's Corner, and I'm speaking with Michael McCarthy about his book detailing the sinking of the SS Eastland a century ago on Lake Michigan. More than 800 people lost their lives. But was this case a bench trial or a jury trial? You said the judge threw it out.
It's a good question. And it's a tad complicated, so bear with me. What happened was most of the defendants were residents of Michigan. And what they did is they fled to their home state. And the trial was to take place in Chicago. But the men at the time were able to argue that we don't want to stand trial in Chicago because we don't feel we'll get a fair trial there. Then it shifts to what's called an extradition proceeding. And that's what we look at in the book about the Eastland. A federal judge is sitting in Grand Rapids, Michigan, the federal district for the area, takes evidence from, as I say, over 90 witnesses to make a determination if he feels there's enough evidence to compel the man to appear in court and face the final charges in trying to pin criminal responsibility for the case. Now, what's interesting is that this extradition hearing was essentially a dress rehearsal for the actual trial. But because the judge said, I don't find enough evidence to compel you to go to Chicago and face trial, it became the final say in terms of criminal responsibility for the Eastland defendants.
So it never really got to the jury, obviously.
Never got to a jury.
Yeah. And yet, when you describe the way Clarence Darrow is acting throughout those 10 days of testimony, boy, he sure sounded like he was talking to a jury, as dramatic as we all have read Clarence Darrow can be in his career overall.
He was brilliant. And he also, for me, one of the interesting and fun things about the book was that Darrow has this, you know, storied career. We know about the Scopes Monkey trial. We know about the young men who were in Chicago facing charges for joy killing. And these are the cases that made his reputation, which were about 10, 15 years after the Eastland case. The Eastland case, though, is one in which he is using all of his theater, all of his booming voice and so forth, just to persuade a single judge. But here's partly why he did it and why the case was so fought so hard at this level. I mentioned it was a dress rehearsal. Both sides knew if they could stop it there, that there'd be no chance for the defendants to come to full trial. So they fought bitterly in the courtroom.
Well, also, Clarence Darrow wasn't exactly the monumental figure in American history at that moment that he winds up to be, because I believe you spent a little bit of time in your book talking about his previous encounter in L.A. where he was dealing with jury tampering.
Right. So this is not a case that I can claim scholarship to. It's not one I studied carefully. But those who've looked at it are convinced that Darrow actually did bribe jurors in that trial and narrowly escaped prosecution for it. So he shows up back in Chicago in 1913. This is 2 years before the Eastland sinks. 1913, he's a disgraced attorney, None of his colleagues, none of the profession of lawyers in Chicago want to have a thing to do with him. He starts taking penny ante cases. He takes small-time thievery, forgery, voter fraud, just ridiculous, you know, small-time cases for such a big national attorney. And along comes Joseph Erickson saying, I need someone to represent me because the owners of Eastland are trying to blame me. They're trying to turn me into the scapegoat, and you can help me. And that's the way Darrow ends up taking the case. Mm-hmm. You have to understand, too, this is a remarkable moment for Darrow. At this point, we literally have evidence of conversations with his wife in which he was ready to give up the law. He thought about writing books. He thought about going on the speaking tour, both of which he really liked a lot. He thought his legal career was over. And the Eastland case is one of the reasons that we still have Darrow, that preserved Darrow's legal career, in which, as I say, in a decade, 15 years later, he becomes the you know, international star that he would become.
Right. Well, if your book plucked Clarence Darrow from the history pages, it did the same with Frank Lloyd Wright in a slightly smaller and perhaps more embarrassing moment. But help us with the fact that these ships, as it turns out, were sometimes used for prostitution, and that's where Frank Lloyd Wright comes in.
Right. So I think I used the phrase "they're dens of sin afloat" or something.
Yeah.
there was gambling going on. There was prostitution. I mean, this is not sort of made up things or memories. This was a Chicago Vice Commission went undercover onto steamships all throughout the area to find out how bad the problem was. What was sort of happening on these floating dens of sin? One of the things they discovered was that their little cabin rooms, the day rooms, were being used for prostitution as well. So the Illinois state passed a law that said that prostitution was now illegal on ships. And what they were trying to do is they were saying, you know, you can't cross state lines and have prostitution and that it becomes a federal crime and so forth. So and it was sort of within that law that was originally aimed at steamship transportation of prostitution that Frank Lloyd Wright, who is a aspiring, not quite the national architect that he was going to become, becomes ensnared when he has an affair with a sculptress and drives her from Illinois into Wisconsin. Well, he crossed state lines with someone for morally reprehensible reasons or something along those lines. And so poor Frank Lloyd Wright ends up ensnared in this law. And by the way, he was defended by Darrow as well later.
Well, when we look back on this phase of history and this steamship business from Chicago to South Haven and other points in Michigan, when did this end, and did the SS Eastland's disaster have anything to do with the fact that today in Chicago, you don't find many boats heading over to South Haven that I know of?
Henry Ford was at work with his assembly line processes, and the introduction of the car really was what killed the steamship business. What I really found interesting about the steamship industry is that it really persisted in this country for about a single generation. It was about 25 years between railroads and the automobile. And one of the reasons I dwell on some of the, maybe if you want to say, salacious elements of the steamship age is because few of us really know what the experience was on steamships. And so one of the things I wanted to explore was just what it was like, to be a passenger, what it was like to be an engineer. As I mentioned earlier, just the aristocratic nature of that form of travel. And by and large, it was here and it was gone. It became much more of a freight industry, and then it was pretty much obsolete.
Well, you've done a beautiful job of portraying a segment of American history, in this case, in the Great Lakes, that really comes to life for all of us and gives us a look back on another era. I can't thank you enough for joining us today, Michael, and thanks so much for the book. The book is Ashes Underwater, the SS Eastland and the Shipwreck That Shook America by Michael McCarthy. Thanks so much for joining us today at Reader's Corner, Michael.
Thank you very much, Bob.
I hope you enjoyed this encore edition of our interview with Michael McCarthy. Next week, my guest is Dr. Leonard Sachs, author of The Collapse of Parenting, How We Hurt Our Kids When We Treat Them Like Grown-Ups. Reader's Corner is presented by Boise State Public Radio. The engineer for today's show is Eric Jones. Research by Kathleen Tuck. Our producer is Janelle Brown. I'm Bob Kustra. Please join me next week as we talk to today's leading writers about the ideas and issues that help shape our world at Reader's Corner.